Almost our only sources of information about the personality of Jesus are derived from the four Gospels, all of which were certainly in existence a few decades after his death, and from allusions to his life in the letters, or the epistles, of the early Christian propagandists. The first three Gospels, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, many suppose to be derived from some earlier documents. The Gospel of St. John has more idiosyncrasy and is coloured by theology of a strongly Hellenic type. Critics are disposed to regard the Gospel of St. Mark as being the most trustworthy account of the personality and actual words of Jesus, but all four agree in giving us a picture of a very definite personality. They carry the same conviction of reality that the early accounts of Buddha do. In spite of miraculous and incredible additions, one is obliged to say, here was a man. This part of the tale couldn't have been invented. But just as the personality of Gautama Buddha has been distorted and obscured by the stiff, squatting figure, the gilded idol of later Buddhism, so one feels that the lean and strenuous personality of Jesus is much wronged by the unreality and conventionality that a mistaken reverence has imposed upon his figure in modern Christian art. Jesus was a penniless teacher who wandered about the dusty, sun-bit country of Judea, living upon casual gifts of food. Yet he's always represented clean, combed and sleek, in spotless raiment, erect, and with something motionless about him, as though he was gliding through the air. This alone has made him unreal and incredible to many people who can't distinguish the core of the story from the ornamental and unwise additions of the unintelligently devout. And it may be that the early parts of the Gospels are accretions of the same nature. The miraculous circumstances of the birth of Jesus, the great star that brought wise men from the east to worship at his manger cradle, the massacre of the male infant children in the region of Bethlehem by Herod as a consequence of these portents, and the flight into Egypt, are all supposed to be such accretionary matter by many authorities. At the best, they're events unnecessary to the teaching, and they rob it of much of the strength and power it possesses when we strip it of such accompaniment. So, too, do the discrepant genealogies given by Matthew and Luke, in which there's an endeavour to trace the direct descendant of Joseph, his father, from King David, as though it was an honour to Jesus, or to anyone, to have such a man as an ancestor. The insertion of these genealogies is the more peculiar and unreasonable because, according to the legend, Jesus wasn't the son of Joseph at all, but miraculously conceived. We're left, if we do strip this record of these difficult accessories, with the figure of a being very human, very earnest and passionate, capable of swift anger, and teaching a new and simple and profound doctrine, namely the universal loving fatherhood of God and the coming of the kingdom of heaven. He was clearly a person, to use a common phrase, of intense personal magnetism. He attracted followers and filled them with love and courage. Weak and ailing people were heartened and healed by his presence, yet he was probably of a delicate physique because of the swiftness with which he died under the pains of crucifixion. There's a tradition that he fainted when, according to the custom, he was made to bear his cross to the place of execution. When he first appeared as a teacher, he was a man of about 30. He went about the country for 3 years, spreading his doctrine, and then he came to Jerusalem and was accused of trying to set up a strange kingdom in Judea. He was tried upon this charge and crucified together with two thieves. Long before these two were dead, his sufferings were over. Now, it's a matter of fact that in the Gospels, all that body of theological assertion which constitutes Christianity finds little support. There is, as the reader may see for himself, no clear and emphatic assertion in these books of the doctrines which Christian teachers of all denominations find generally necessary to salvation. Except for one or two passages in St. John's Gospel, it's difficult to get any words actually ascribed to Jesus in which he claimed to be the Jewish Messiah, rendered in Greek by the Christ. And still more difficult is it to find any claim to be a part of the Godhead, or any passage in which he explained the doctrine of the atonement, or urged any sacrifices or sacraments, that's to say, priestly offices upon his followers. We shall see presently how later on all Christendom was torn by disputes about the Trinity. There's no evidence that the apostles of Jesus ever heard of the Trinity, at any rate from him. The observance of the Jewish Sabbath, again transferred to the Mithraic Sun Day, is an important feature of many Christian cults, but Jesus deliberately broke the Sabbath and said that it was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Nor did he say a word about the worship of his mother Mary in the guise of Isis, the Queen of Heaven. All that's most characteristically Christian in worship and usage, he ignored. Skeptical writers have had the temerity to deny that Jesus can be called a Christian at all. For light upon these extraordinary gaps in his teaching, each reader must go to his own religious guides. Here we are bound to mention these gaps on account of the difficulties and controversies that arose out of them, and we're equally bound not to enlarge upon them. As remarkable is the enormous prominence given by Jesus to the teaching of what he called the Kingdom of Heaven, and its comparative insignificance in the procedure and teaching of most of the Christian churches. This doctrine of the Kingdom of Heaven, which was the main teaching of Jesus, and which plays so small a part in the Christian creeds, is certainly one of the most revolutionary doctrines that ever stirred and changed human thought. It's small wonder if the world of that time failed to grasp its full significance and recoiled in dismay from even a half appreciation of its tremendous challenges to the established habits and institutions of mankind. It's small wonder if the hesitating convert and disciple presently went back to the old familiar ideas of temple and altar, of fierce deity and propitiatory observance, of consecrated priest and magic blessing, and, these things being attended to, reverted then to the dear old habitual life of hates and profits and competition and pride. For the doctrine of the Kingdom of Heaven, as Jesus seems to have preached it, was no less than a bold and uncompromising demand for a complete change and cleansing of the life of our struggling race, an utter cleansing without and within. To the Gospels, the reader must go for all that is preserved of this tremendous teaching. Here, we're only concerned with the jar of its impact upon established ideas. The Jews were persuaded that God, the one God of the whole world, was a righteous God, but they also thought of him as a trading God, who had made a bargain with their father Abraham about them, a very good bargain indeed for them, to bring them at last to predominance in the earth. With dismay and anger, they heard Jesus sweeping away their dear securities. God, he taught, was no bargainer. There were no chosen people and no favorites in the Kingdom of Heaven. God was the loving Father of all life, as incapable of showing favor as the universal Son. And all men were brothers, sinners alike and beloved sons alike of this divine Father. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, Jesus casts scorn upon the natural tendency we all obey to glorify our own people and to minimize the righteousness of other creeds and other races. In the parable of the laborers, he thrust aside the obstinate claim of the Jews to have a sort of first mortgage upon God. All whom God takes into the kingdom, he taught, God serves alike. There is no distinction in his treatment because there's no measure to his bounty. From all, moreover, as the parable of the buried talent witnesses, and as the incident of the widow's mite enforces, he demands the utmost. There are no privileges, no rebates, and no excuses in the Kingdom of Heaven. But it wasn't only the intense tribal patriotism of the Jews that Jesus outraged.